Speaker of the day is Julius Borsea from Stockholm.
So thank you to the organizers, and maybe I should double that and thank them for the extension I got for my talk.
Well, your extension is now reduced.
Yeah, which is kind of reduced to... So I was offered a 30-minute extension, which will be a 20 or 90 minutes extension. And it was, of course, a pleasant task of having more time to talk about these things. Although it's slightly difficult because I had to re-expand some of the material that I initially prepared so as to make it fit into 30 minutes. So I'll maybe start with an overview of the subject that I want to talk about, which one might call theory and applications of multivariate stable polynomials. And actually one might add even transcendental entire functions for many purposes. So this thing here is really a sort of a subtitle. And I'll explain in a minute what I mean by stable. Is this thing on? Actually, because I can't. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
So stable means that your class of polynomials is defined in terms of no vanishing conditions. But I'll come back to this later. If you want to do this in a sort of systematic way, then there are several facets, several sides to it. One part would maybe have to deal with sort of structural theory. And this would include all sorts of geometric analytic algebraic aspects. By this I mean you try to extract as much information as possible from your defining properties, and so that's encoded there, and translate it in terms of various properties for your class of polynomials. Be it, for instance, closure properties, or maybe relations for coefficients, or maybe so various properties this coefficient satisfy, or maybe very important aspect would be algorithmic side of things, trying to see if there are any effective tests or criteria for deciding whether your polynomial has the specified type, and so on and so forth. So we try to build sort of a fundamentals on which we try to build up this thing. Another part of this thing would have to deal with what one might call invariant theory, by which I mean you have a class of polynomials, stable in some sense. Describe, characterize, classify all linear operators preserving this class of polynomials. And this has already, in univariate case, a long history. These things have a life of their own in the classical complex, one variable complex analysis dealing with this theory distribution of zeros of polynomials and entire functions, of course. But besides that, there are important aspects of this part having to do with what Alan Sokol, among other, explained last week, Lian type theorems in statistical mechanics. And another part of this sort of systematic treatment of the subject will have to do with applications. There are lots of them, as we've seen this week and last week, already in combinatorics and statistical mechanics. But there are many more in probability theory, in matrix theory, and many other subjects. So my original aim was to focus on sort of part three and a few glimpses of part one, how you use some of these properties. And many people worked on that. I mean, it's in the univariate case, there's a huge literature, of course, but in recent years, a lot of people worked on multivariate polynomials for various reasons, and have egoistic or self-centered way. Let me give you a few references of the papers that he wrote on this. So they're all on archive, on the archive. So what I was going to focus mostly on is this paper with Peter Brindley and Tom Leggett called Negative Dependence and the Geometry of Polynomials. But maybe I'll touch on a few things having to do with other papers he wrote on these subjects. Another one is called Poyashu something, Master Theorems. And for applications to, for instance, matrix theory, there's a paper on called Exact Applications of Stable Polynomials to Matrix Theory. Johnson's conjectures, symmetrized Fisher products, for new modalities, and so on and so forth. There's another paper called Classification of Something of Multivariate Stability Preservers by an algebra case. Peter wrote a very nice paper on polynomials with the half plane property, and so on and so forth. And maybe in a week or two, there will be something called Liang, and probably 2 weeks. And so that was my initial intention. And I guess that everything I just said is sort of an elaborate excuse for sticking to this initial plan and doing exactly that, focusing on some applications. And these applications will be very much in the spirit of Giancarlo Rota. So you may all be familiar with his, I don't know how famous, but well-known philosophy about his contribution to combinatorics. The one thing he wants to be remembered for mostly is the fact that many things in combinatorics have to do with the location of zeros, polynomials. And we all know that, we've seen that. But this same philosophy applies to a great many things. Phase transitions, Liang type theorems, you already saw. Matrix theory, station theory, total positivity. I'll try to focus on things that have to do mostly with this last part, negative dependence, interacting particle systems. So, what is a stable polynomial in this business? So I'll put on a slide, but before going into that, let me make a very general definition. Namely, you take any set proper of a complex plane so as to build a non-trivial theory, and you say that a polynomial f is omega stable if it is non-vanishing whenever all variables lie there in your prescribed set omega. Okay, so for instance, in the univariate case, if you take omega to be the outside of the unit disk, you get what people call shoe stability, or so look at all complex polynomials with which are non-vanishing there. If you take polynomials with real coefficients in one variable whose zeros lie strictly in the left half plane, so omega is your right half plane, closed one, then this is what's usually known on Fourier stability, and so on and so forth. Now, in the definition I put up there, we make this convention that we focused on the upper half plane, H. So omega is the upper half plane. And the color polynomial is stable if it's non-vanishing whenever all variables lie in the upper half plane. And real stable if it's, in addition, it has only real coefficients. In the same manner, you can say a polynomial of the real coefficients, which is omega stable, is real omega stable. So there are, of course, various related notions being studied, like the half-plane property that Choi, Oxley, Sokal, and Wagner studied. And they are related, of course. And Alan Sokal mentioned last week that I should argue in favor of the upper half plane instead of the right half plane. I'll not say why the upper half plane is better than the right half plane. I won't really say that. So I won't make a case of the upper versus the right half plane. I just say that it depends on your motivation and context. Well, what you're interested in.
Right, well, the two are...
But having said that...
They're identical if the polynomial is homogeneous.
Yeah.
They're trivially equivalent if you allow general polynomials. If you consider polynomials with real coefficients that are not homogeneous, then they're two different theories, and they're both interesting.
So having said that, it doesn't really matter, or it depends on the purposes. Let me now tell you why the upper half plane is better than the right half plane. So as Alan said, of course, for complex coefficient, it doesn't matter. It's just a shift in the phase. For real homogeneous polynomials, of course, it doesn't matter. For real non-homogeneous polynomials, then it matters. But I'll come back to that later. But let's think first in terms of historical reasons. So upper half plane is bounded by real axes. And in the beginning of time, or in the beginning, everything had only real zeros, if any. And it took mankind a while to take the jump into the imaginary direction. It was almost a leap of faith, but it paid off. So real rootedness. But that's more of a philosophical argument. There are deeper reasons than that. One is that already in the univariate case, you can show that polynomials which are stable with respect to the upper half plane are built up from real rooted polynomials. And for the right half plane, or almost whole instability, there are similar, albeit not quite as natural as when I said results. You have to use Z square and something like this. There are also other reasons, namely that the real entire function is real on the real axis. And if you think of a function, think of the Schwarz reflection principle, you have an analytic function up here, which is real on the real axis. The Schwarz reflection principle gives you a natural way of continuing it analytically below. Although you ran into anti-holomorphic stuff like this, you don't have a corresponding thing for the imaginary axis. And there's still a deeper reason why the upper is sort of better. Coming to the question of the case of real non-homogeneous polynomials, namely, it turns out that for many interesting polynomials, which are polynomials with real non-negative, although usually by R plus I mean positive coefficients, if such a polynomial is stable in the sense upper half plane, it turns out that it will be stable with respect to the right half plane also. More than that, it will be stable actually with respect to any half plane bounded by line through the origin that contains the point 1, 1, 0. In the univariate case, it's pretty easy to see. So what does it mean in the univariate case for a polynomial to be stable with respect to the upper half plane? It means that it has all real zeros. If in addition it has all non-negative coefficients, it means that all its zeros should lie on the negative half axis. And of course, it will be stable then with respect to the right half plane. This sort of thing generalizes to the multivariate case. So I have an extra edge, to avoid any graph theoretical confusion. So I have some leverage, extra flexibility, when you're working in the upper half plane. Many polynomials you encounter have non-negative coefficients. And there are also other related notions. One of them, very important, is the notion of hyperbolic polynomial, studied mostly to begin with in the theory of partial differential equations. I usually add the name Golding or Garding for non-Swedish speakers, maybe are a majority in the audience. Goes back to Petrovsky and so on and so forth, and there's a very well developed theory of hyperbolic polynomial in connection with PDEs, who culminate in the works of Atiyah, both Golding, Helmander. What is a hyperbolic polynomial? It should be a real homogeneous polynomial, and it's said to be hyperbolic in direction E, so a vector E in Rn, if, when you take the restriction of this polynomial to any line with this prescribed direction, V, I called it here, then it should have all real zeros. So you see, it's a natural multivariate extension of the notion of real rootedness. And stability of the receptor upper half plane is also a natural multivariate extension of the notion of real rootedness. The two of them are related, as I'll mention later on. And well, in this context, maybe I should say that in the structural theory, one question is, how can you represent the sort of representation theory included in this structural theory? Can you represent this polynomial stable or hyperbolic by means of, for instance, determinants or other sorts of that show often be very useful for many purposes? And in this hyperbolic polynomial context, once we should maybe mention the Lax conjecture, goes back to 58, which is now a theorem since 2005, I guess, due to Helton and Vinnikov and Lewis. Well, the main argument based on heavy complex algebraic stuff was due to Helton and Vinnikov. Lewis and Parilla and Ramana proved it. It says the following, that you have a homogeneous polynomial in three variables. Let's call them x, y, z, of some degree, d. And if this, well, this polynomial f is hyperbolic hip with respect to, for normalization purposes, let's take the vector 1, 0, 0, if and only if it can be represented in this fashion, f of x, y, z is equal to f of, let's call this vector e. The term, so up to constant factor, is the same as the determinant of x times the identity matrix plus y times a plus z times b, where a, b, and the identity matrix all are d times d matrices, and a and b are symmetric. It's easy to see that any such polynomial, that means such representation, will be hyperbolic in this direction. The converse was the hard part. And this gives you sort of a very useful link to matrix theory. You can prove all sorts of things like Lidsky-type theorems and Van Horn-type theorems for hyperbolic polynomials by means of matrix theory. And there's a lot of work of Gurwitz, for instance, on the van der Waerden conjecture and so on and so forth.
Can such a thing possibly be true for more than three variables?
So I'll comment on that. Let me say first that from this three-dimensional Lax conjecture for hyperbolic, we can easily deduce a similar thing for real stable polynomial in two variables. That's included in this one of the papers there. And then Alan's question is very natural. Can a thing like this hold in four or more dimensions? No, it fails for four or more because of, you don't have enough parameters. There are remedies suggested or conjectured. So in this Duke, in this paper, I guess we have there some alternatives for higher dimensions, namely use mixed determinants, whatever they are. So instead of a single determinant, they pencils of matrices and then build up sort of mixed determinants. You generalize in all sorts of ways the characteristic polynomial of a matrix.
Okay. But you are not claiming there that you exhaust all the hyperbolic polynomials.
So we stated as a problem, and Viktor Vinnikov has something similar, although not in terms of mixed determinants, but they add up an extra factor in front of the determinant. I think they should be equivalent. They stayed their thing as a conjecture because they dared doing this. We state it as a problem. We think that it should be enough to cover up everything in four or more. So it's explicit in this paper, two problems. So much about matrix theory for now. And let's go a bit faster. Namely, define other notions of polynomials. Notion of Raleigh polynomial, which P. Mantle calls H and LC plus, that stands for hereditary negative lattice condition plus, in the strong sense, whatever this is. But it amounts to saying that you have a multi-affine, so square-free polynomial in n variables with non-negative real coefficients that satisfies this inequality. So for all positive values of your variables, this correlator should be non-negative. This Raleigh expression. Why is it a Raleigh expression? Yeah, because you already saw many of the talks, and you've seen Alan Sokol's talk. This connection to Kirchhoff-Raleigh. Let me put an extra slide. So in connection with the spanning tree polynomial, you have so this thing at the bottom here, the Kirchhoff-Raleigh, let's call it, theorem. You build the effect of conductance or resistance when you pick up two vertices in a graph. And it turns out, I think it's Raleigh who really proved this, that it is monotonically decreasing in Zj for positive Zj. And this expression, this numerator here, it's exactly the same sort of expression that comes in there. And let's call a polynomial strongly Raleigh. This correlate there, this inequality holds not only for all positive but for all real numbers. So this is this expression. And then 2 years and something more back, when we were working on this stuff, you noticed, and actually Peter included it in this beautiful paper about half-plane property, a striking fact that if you require this, that you allow your correlator to be non-negative for all real variables, not only for the positive ones, then strongly Raleigh amounts to real stable, real stability. And so Peter's theorem. So the initial theorem proved by Vronsky and stuff, there's a nice or more elegant proof now. Anyway, why is this good for? It's very good because it gives you a link to the geometric side of things. So the geometry, you have an underlying geometry for real stable polynomials. And I'll come to this in a...
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, to me, this looks very surprising. I mean, which is why it's such a beautiful theorem. I mean, on the one hand, you have a hypothesis, a finite number of inequalities for how the polynomial behaves on Rn. And nevertheless, you deduce something about the zeros in a big chunk of Cn. That's surprising. And another way of stating it is, there were two different properties of electrical networks, one having to do with monotonicity for real values of the conductances, the other having to do with stability for complex values of the conductances. And we thought that they were two different properties, which just happened to both be true. And now you're saying they're related.
Positivity comes into the game. Is this where total positivity comes into the game?
No. Total positivity is borrowed most from matrix theory. So totally positive matrix is one. If these things look more like 2x2 minors.
Yeah, even for 2x2, there's a certain notion for 2x2.
Two positivity and so on. You can prove it in terms of Vronskians that these are 2x2 determinants. This is the original proof, but it's not really what I meant to when I said total positivity in this context. There are things related to Schur positivity and so on and so forth. I'll come back to total positivity Well, if I keep on so slow, I'll never come back to anything. And, so the proof is not very hard. It really is just about, oh, Vronsky and then reduces the thing to one variable case. Only now, I have a much, so that we try to rebuild the thing almost from scratch, so we don't have to use anything except basics like Hurwitz's theorem on continuity of zeros or maximum principle for harmonic functions and stuff like this. And I'll have a proof for this in this way. But Peter's theorem is a very nice one indeed, and powerful, as we shall hopefully see. Let me go on, so these slides are now in random order, so examples I already gave, but let me say that, so real rooted polynomial in the univariate case, we'll see, and Alan already told you that spanning tree polynomial is stable, real stable, half-life property, this is also known. But let me introduce some notation that ever so slowly will get us to the main point, because I look at probabilities, and let Pn, script Pn be the set of all multi-affine polynomials with non-negative coefficients, normalized so the total mass is 1, the sum of all coefficients is 1, and as this multi-index notation, z to the s will be the product of all variables zi with index I in the set s. And then fracture Pn is the set of all probability measures on this Boolean lattice, the power set of your given set of n elements. Actually, so we pretty much followed P-Mantle. So P-Mantle has this paper towards the theory of negative dependence when he gathers pretty much all known and unknown facts in this business. And he concentrates on this model of having binary random variables so as to simplify things. But many things, including those we did, generalize to more general lattices. But let's just use binary random variables for now, and there's a one-on-one correspondence between the two, so the set of multi-affine polynomials like this, and this set of probability measures, you simply consider the generating polynomial for any such measure. And pretty much everything you want to know about your measure is encoded in the generating polynomial. So you now translate everything in terms of polynomials, multi-affine. And you call such a measure strongly Riley if its generating polynomial is strongly Riley, meaning that these inequalities are satisfied for all real variables. Now, one of the key notions we want to study is the negative version of the notion of positive association. Positive association means that for all increasing, or really non-decreasing functions, fg on your lattice, this inequality should be satisfied up there. So I express it in terms of some expenses fg and mu of f and mu of g. A related notion, a weaker one, would say, or think, is the PLC, positive lattice condition, meaning this, that the product of, you take any two subsets, S and T, and the product of measure of S meets T, S joint T is greater than or equal to the product of measures for S and for T. Now, the second one is sort of a local condition, whereas the first one is sort of a global one. The striking or fundamental result in this theory is the FKG, Fortuyn-Castellain-Ginivre theorem, saying that the positive lattice condition implies positive association. This is really a fundamental thing that allows you to prove. So this is a sort of a local to global device allowing you to prove all sorts of interesting inequalities and correlations. But what if you look at the negative side of that? So sort of negative dependence, if you define negative association of being the same thing as up there, all in the reverse inequality.
Oh, I'm sorry, there's some typo, S and T.
I think it should. It's true that I mixed slides from several talks, but I think this version should be correct. So there's when you want to have the reverse inequality, now I have to be careful because you cannot just consider any increasing events, fg. They have to depend on these joint center variables. If nothing else, if you take f and f, well, easy, maybe by Cauchy-Schwarz or anything, you see that they will always be positively correlated. So intuitively speaking, this says it's negative association that if a set of random variables goes up, then any other disjoint sets should go down, sort of. But the question is, and in this paper of Pimentel and many other people, Lyons and Liggett and so on and so forth, that one really needs a theory of negative dependence. And mostly there's this question, under what condition can we, or easily checkable conditions, can we get negative association? And there are many models where negative association or phenomena of negative dependence pop up, as you already saw in many of the talks. Yeah, well, negative lattice condition, random cluster model of Q less than 1, uniform random spanning tree measures, NA according to Feder and Mihail. But there are many more instances of that, of negative dependence, including in matrix theory, one can formulate inequalities between or minors related to matrices, view them as instances of negative dependence, and also in entire function theory, any sort of Newton-type inequalities, like Laguerre-Turan inequalities, so on and so forth, may be viewed as phenomena having to do with negative dependence. Now, so one really needs a sort of a theory explaining when can you be sure of getting negative association. Well, let me briefly mention a stronger notion of negative association, CNA plus. There are plenty of acronyms like this in this business. So this stands for conditionally negatively association in the strong sense plus with projections and external fields. This is Pimentel's notion. What it really means is, now we think in terms of polynomials, this is generalizing polynomials. They are closed real stable polynomials undertaking limits, right? This is the Hurwitz continuity of zeros theory in multivariate case. They are also closed under partial differentiation. This corresponds, this partial differentiation, so when you differentiate your multi-affine polynomial with respect to, say, variable zj, this really corresponds to conditioning on the jth coordinate function being 1 equal to 1. Then other closure properties of multi-affine real stable polynomial are that they are invariant under scaling of variables of positive numbers. So if you multiply the variables of positive numbers and your polynomial was real stable, you get a new real stable polynomial. And this corresponds to the, so, to the external fields that you have in thoroughbinary condensing models.
But
so
you were using strongly lately here, so does it matter whether so or let not me, your let numbers me, are positive?
Let
That's
me,
my question.
So what?
You're saying you're scaling by positive numbers. Does it really matter because you're using strongly really? I mean, you can.
So what I'm saying is the following thing. If you have a real stable polynomial, I don't know if you see all the variables here, then this one will be real stable again. Then this one will also be real stable whenever all your alphas are positive. Then if you consider a sequence of real stable polynomials, and this real stability is the same as strongly Raleigh. So, and these properties, closure properties of polynomials, correspond to this operation called conditioning, projections, external fields. In probabilistic terms. So taking the jth derivative on your real stable polynomial is same as condition on the jth coordinate function being 1. External fields having to do this plus condition out there has to do with this simple closure property of real stable polynomials. And projection, setting variables equal to non-negative numbers. So what happens is that you can project your measure from your Boolean essence to the n power set to the end to a smaller one, you forget about a certain number of variables, integrate them all. All of these properties combined give you this stronger notion of CNA plus. That's what I mean. It's negative association that I defined on the previous slide, plus these 2, 3, 4 conditions, give you this stronger notion, the strongest as yet, or one of the strongest. Another thing that we proved, one of the things we proved is that the class of strongly Raleigh measures meaning they are generating polynomials are real stable. This class measured is CNA plus, so strongly negatively associated. And this class includes quite a number of interesting measures, like the uniform random spanning tree measures, product measures, balls and beans measures, also studied by Dubash and Ranjan and so in the mid-90s. Although for balls and beans measures, I'll never come to that. You have to use more general lattices because you really will work with non-multi-affine polynomials.
Sorry, Julius, is that theorem an implication or an equivalence?
Which one?
The theorem there.
No, it's just an implication.
Okay.
I mean, the whole business would be pretty much wrapped up if it were a... if time allows, which will not, I'll come back to this very subtle. So far I'm saying that using the geometry, so strongly Riley builds upon real stability. Real stability means a lot of geometric information. This was key, this geometric information encoded there, to proving strong negative association. Now, once you go outside the realm of geometric sets of polynomials, like you have the notion of Riley polynomials, then it's a big open question, is Riley, HNLC plus, so non-strongly Riley, the same of CNA plus? No answer to that as yet. But, I'd rather not speculate about it in public anyway. A very interesting class of measures included here is the class of determinantal measures that in itself contains, let me just talk about it as an example. Determinantal measures are induced by matrices. So if you pick up any matrix with principal minors all non-negative, so this is called P matrices, positive matrices. And, a determinantal measure is one which is defined by this matrix. So you pick any subset S of your set 1 to n. Mu of S is this minor A of S divided by determinant I plus A is for normalization property, so the total mass of your mu should be 1. This is a determinantal measure. It's generating polynomials written here. So if you take capital Z being the diagonal matrix with indeterminants Z1, Zn, you form this determinant and you normalize it by this factor, you get the generating polynomial of this measure. And this in itself is very interesting because it relates to all sorts of things, including fashionable stuff. Well, it relates to all sorts of fermionic point processes and continuous scaling limits of that. And there was this big thing of Montgomery about distribution of Riemann zeta functions, and Corey and other people's work about that, and orthogonal polynomial ensembles. They pop in there, these determinantal measures, and also in other people's work about, they look at Poissonized versions of the Poincaré measures on partitions. So it's quite an interesting class in itself, anyway. Let me give you an instance of negative dependence properties in terms of matrix theory. Namely, there are these well-known Adamov-Fischer-Kotelianski inequalities. If you take a positive semi-definite matrix, then in order of strength, the weakest one, the Adamov inequality says that the determinant is bounded by the product of the diagonal entries. This is then generalized by Fischer's inequality. S prime is the complement set of S. And the Kotelianski inequality really looks like a negative lattice condition. And Lyons proved that if you have a positive semi-definite measure, then its induced measure, the determinantal measure mu A, is CNA plus. But you see that because of the fact that the determinantal measures I included in this strongly Riley class that we defined. This theorem, of course, is implied by this theorem. And also by the fact that, it's not that difficult to see what I meant here by this result. This is not very difficult to see that any such polynomial defined as a determinant in this way is stable, I rather refer to this generalization in terms of mixed determinants. But anyway, this thing says you that any positive semidefinite matrix, its determinantal measure is real stable. So that's why it's included in the Strombi-Rolle clause. So this matrix theoretic inequalities really means something like in terms of negative dependence. And what you can do is to define a class of Rolle matrices. So you call a positive semidefinite matrix Rolle, or rather no, you call a P matrix, matrix of all principal minors, non-negative, Rolle, if its associated determinantal measure is Rolle, meaning the correlator greater than or equal to zero for all non-negative values of the entries. And then Dave Wagner showed, maybe not in these terms, that any such Rolle matrix is a GKK matrix. GKK stands for Gantt-Mahal-Krein-Kotelianski matrices. These are P matrices that satisfy the Kotelianski inequalities. You didn't use this terminology, but you have a theorem about this. Yeah. And then an interesting question would be, characterize these scribal Rolle matrices, one of the many things that are included in this paper. Maybe because time is running out, should come to something to do with graphs. If you consider this you already saw many a times in these weeks and last week's talks about the Laplacian of a graph and Kirchhoff's matrix T theorem, giving the spanning tree polynomials in terms of any principal minor of the Laplacian. And these operations are quite simple now when reviewed anything in terms of determinants and derivatives of real stable polynomials. So this is another proof of the fact that the spanning tree polynomial is stable or not. It's pretty much, they're all pretty much equivalent. Alan Sokol and Dave Wagner in this big paper, they also have proofs of that. And then you have sort of an extension. You build this polynomial, I call here F sub G, where you sum all rooted spanning forests. Forest, and I wanted to mention that because Dave Wagner had a conjecture that we also managed to prove about this measure here that you can define this. You take each spanning forest and let rho be the number of ways you can root this forest and define a probability.
What does that mean, the number of ways you can root it?
So you can pick up one distinguished vertex as a root. And
in each component?
Yeah, in each
component. So it's just the product of the cardinalities of the component.
That's how David expressed it.
This was an observation that should never have been made a conjecture. It was really easy, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we speculated about maybe using Grassmann-Berezin calculus, but not for that, because it's not only Rolle, it's strongly Rolle, and it's easy to see.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So it's a more serious stuff. If you're hungry for more, and dinner is pretty soon. The symmetric exclusion process used to model traffic flow and biopolymers essentially have particles moving on a countable set. And if you follow in continuous time, and this would be a Markov chain when you follow the motion of each particle, except that you cannot have two particles per site. So they exchange places, say, at the probability P, ij, particle I and particle j. This gives polynomial operations like this, namely that you pick up any measure on your Boolean lattice and you form this new measure, a partial sort of symmetrization, p is a number between 0 and 1, and tau is just any transposition. You form the new measure which is defined like this. So the weighted mean of mu of s and mu of tau s meaning all the elements, tau small s in s. What it turns out, and again, you kind of have to use structural theory or properties, is that if your measure is statically strongly Rolle, then this partial symmetrization of your measure is again strongly Rolle. So this process, this partial symmetrization that corresponds to the symmetric exclusion process preserves strongly Rolle. And in particular, this proves this conjecture about the distribution of time t of any symmetric exclusion process whose initial configuration is deterministic, and this is, so deterministic means a point mass on your lattice, or they conjecture for product measures. Well, this distribution will be negative associated, but the theorem here proves much more, because it says the conclusion of this theorem is that if the initial configuration is strongly Raleigh, that there's a very special case into the deterministic bond. Then your distribution of time t will be negatively associated. Now, one of the key ideas, and I'm very sorry, you'll never get to see sort of the flavor of it. In the proof of the fact that strongly Raleigh measures are strongly negatively associated, well, you have to do several things. One of the things you had to do, well, just sort of the natural constructions, sort of double the measure and construct a symmetric homogenization of this measure. So you have a measure on power set 2 to the n, you define its homogenization as a measure on power set 2 to the 2n in this way. That may look a bit fancy, so I won't read what it says. But anyway, when I look at this new measures generating polynomial, it will involve your initial variables z1, zn, and then two n extra variables zn plus 1, z2n, that come in a symmetric fashion here, because these e's stand for the symmetric, elementary symmetric polynomials. And what happens is that...
So for every set of cardinality k in the first n elements, you throw in all possible sets of cardinality n minus k in the...
We want homogeneity.
In all possible...
And exactly. Exactly. And homogeneity will show to be very important in what's symmetric in the new variables. And this is actually a canonical construction, but because this homogenization is unique polynomial in 2n variables satisfying this and that, but when I said the new variables equal to 1, you'll get back your initial polynomial. So there are not that many ways to go about it. But the fact is that this doubling procedure, this symmetric homogenization, is again strongly Raleigh. So this new generating polynomial will again be real stable if your initial one is. And the canvas is really easy by Grace once again. And the sketch of proof, let me just show you that, and then show you some more, is that if you start with a stable polynomial, then you use these guarding results that I alluded to a little bit, and also this fact about rotating planes, the flexibility that the upper half plane gives you as opposed to the right half plane that some people use. And from that, you can then use the Gray-Schwarz-Segur coincidence theorem. If you don't know what this is, well, I'm very sorry, I don't have time to explain it. It says essentially that you have a circular domain, anything you can get from the unit disk by a Möbius transformation, and a polynomial which is symmetric, multi-affine, then you can get any value of this polynomial by just picking out a single point there in your given circular domain. That's what is called coincidence theorem. So f of z1, zn will always be, you'll always find some z in the same circular domain, so f of z1, zn will be equal to f of z. You can collapse all your variables. And so very sketchy. And then the second thing, the second link, the second ingredient is the Feder-Mihalj theorem, saying that, so they use this to show that uniform spanning tree measures are Na. But the key, they didn't really formulate things in this way. The key idea was theirs, and the proof is sort of scattered throughout the literature, and Lyon's book on the web has some parts of it. We also give some details. And Dave Wagner also in his paper talks about this. It gives you a sufficient condition for Glasson measures to be Na, where the homogeneous condition of the generated polynomial and these so-called pairwise negative correlations in condition B are key to the fact that your class will be negatively associated. And fact is that any strongly Raleigh measure homogeneous generated polynomial will satisfy this, and the Na property is closed under projection. And let me abuse of your patience and say that in this paper we have a whole lot of more positive results about negative dependence. P. Mantle's many of the conjectures are either proved or disproved. And also many of Lyons' results that really standard about this Lerner or than stochastic nomination. Can read more. Nevertheless, this remains a big open question whether Raleigh is the same as CNA plus.
Did I conjecture that?
You have it, but P-Mantle already had it. Although, had to, you know, because of all this HNLC plus.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Raleigh. So in the paper, we have a diagram where we show all the implication relations because between all these acronyms, whatever they mean. So you use a different, you arrived at it for different reasons. Right, but it still remains open. So what happens is that this is true for so-called exchangeable measures, so symmetric in all variables, but we also prove now that it's true for symmetric in all but one variable, because this came up as a natural construction in the counterexamples. And there are many other things. Now that you have these necessary tools, so once you have negative association, you can use probability tail bounds, Chernoff bounds, whatever, so we can prove strong correlation inequalities. And Tom Liggett has pursued that. And there are many more things that you can do. And let me rush things over a bit and say that the initial title of this paper was this one, Negative Results on Negative Dependence, because it all started off by disproving Dave Wagner's big conjecture. And the big conjecture says something about the ultra-low concavity, which is a strong form of Newton's inequality, for the rank sequence of the measure. So the rank sequence, you just set all variables equal, and you pick up the coefficients. This will give you the so-called rank sequence. Sorry for that. I will put on the very last slide and say that, of course, if you have a real stable polynomial and you set all variables equal, you will get the real rooted polynomials, and by Newton's well-known classical inequalities, the rank sequence then will be ultra log concave. This is just what Newton's inequality says. So any strongly Raleigh is ULC, ultra log concave, for obvious reasons, from Newton's inequality. Big conjecture was that any Raleigh, so this weaker form of strongly Raleigh, when your correlator was non-negative for all positive variables, it should have an ULC ultra log concave rank sequence. If true, this would have proved Mason's conjecture, long-standing one, for Raleigh matrices, to include the series parallel graphs, and I think it's still it's conjecture, right? The graphic and regular matrices. It's a reasonably large class, anyway. But unfortunately, this is not true. Well, I mean, it's not true, period. And another conjecture was that if you have any strongly negative dissociation measure, CNA plus, then it should be ULC. It's not true either. I won't show the construction, which is kind of technical. We had to go up to 20 variables from some numerical example, but this multivariate ideology that Alan so-called explained so well in several talks, and kind of similar to the way they found counterexamples to the Brown-Colvin conjectures, and you would never guess without going to multivariate, sort of. Well, we reduced the big conjecture to a little problem about log concavity of combinations of sequences and so on and so forth. But I'm afraid I won't be able to tell you what I really wanted to tell you. So there's much more to it. And let me say that, okay, it may sound nice and well to go to the multivariate, but once when you do that, you really have to include the univariate. There's a huge literature on the univariate case, and to extend the univariate ideology, but in a sort of compatible way, of course. And having said that, it's not that the univariate case is wrapped up. As usual, I mean, in such a classical subject, classical analysis is one variable, the leftovers are only difficult problems, right? So, an example is that is this classification of problem of classifying all linear operators that preserve the set of all polynomials or real zeros. So this goes back to at least the Poiachur and Laguerre and Hermitius. And only recently was this done in this Arnold paper in Poiachur master theorems. The similar thing in multivariate would kind of unify Liang type theorems. And this is kind of zero stuff that I added there. Well, maybe we should hopefully add some big positive integer to make all labels strictly positive. There will be more to this sequel, and many people are working on that for various reasons, but you can always pick up something good for whatever you're interested, being it a match rate or a graph, because, so that's I, to be my final words, because of the underlying geometry. So the fact that your polynomials are defined by non-vanishing problem, meaning a lot in geometric terms. You can extract a lot of good information from that. Once this fails, as you saw for Raleigh, you have to find something else. Okay, thank you for your time. Sorry for.
I think we have time for one or two questions.
So, I didn't see the invariant theory aspect that you mentioned.
I don't think he means invariant theory in your sense.
Oh, okay, so totally.
So, when I wrote this, I should have perhaps added. This one, because I thought about people in the audience, and including Malek, would interpret this in that sense, the usual invariant theory. But what I meant is things that leave your set of polynomials invariant, a linear transformation that preserve your set of polynomials. So if you want, of course, you can relate maybe some Schubert counters or whatever, Hilbert stuff, but it's not what I meant.
I'd just like to mention one possible fix for the big conjecture that you found a very nice counterexample to that's related to some inequalities that Olga proved. Suppose you've got a determinantal measure and it's Raleigh, then perhaps its generating function is ultra-log concave, because your examples are not determinantal measures.
No, they are not. They are almost exchangeable, but I don't think that. Well, not. It's not that definite. I'm not sure you could find a matrix so as to realize this. These measures we have there as determinantal measures. You may be right. Yeah.
Well, it's a possibility that cuts out your counterexample. And believe me, since the last time we talked, I thought of other ways of.
But I want to talk more about it anyway. Not in public. I mean, to make a fool of yourself in private. Because actually, and this is a long shot, I am inclined to believe that Mason's in full generality would not be true.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
That's very unlikely.
Yeah. And so we talked about polynomials and measures. And from this counterexample, I think that you could somehow construct a counterexample. Okay, you'd have to have zeros, one in your coefficient and stuff like this. But first you take out from our counterexample something that has only rational coefficients, and then you level up, you take out the denominators, and then polarize in some sense, adding huge amount of variables so as to get only zero ones.
And make sure it's still a matroid?
And make sure it's still a matroid. Something like this. I mean, it's a bit optimistic.
And
this was because it was a sunny day, but on a rainy day, you think that nothing works. But
okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank Julius and thank all the speakers.